Welcome back to The Road Untraveled. I'm your host, Brian Hollins, and today we have Namdi Okike, co-founder and managing partner of 645 Ventures, a seed stage firm that applies an institutional model to investing in early stage companies. Prior to 645, Namdi spent 8 years at Insight Venture Partners, where he invested in 18 companies and had 9 exits, with exit value exceeding $6 billion. Namdi and I cover a lot of current topics, including how to leverage data to source deal flow, this notion of the behavioral change economy, and some great advice for Black and underrepresented minority founders. I hope you enjoy our chat. This is The Road Untraveled.
So excited to have you here. For anyone just joining us, Namdi's from 645 Ventures, and I'm really looking forward to diving into this discussion. Namdi, just for anyone that's joining, maybe just give them a little bit of a sense of what 645 is and how you guys got started.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. And it's a pleasure to join. So, you know, we're an early stage venture fund. We focus on seed to series A investments. We do both B2B and B2C. Majority of our deals are B2B. So enterprise SaaS, enterprise infrastructure, software primarily. We will also do select consumer deals, primarily online marketplaces. You know, typically we're investing in companies post-launch, so typically kind of early revenue traction and, you know, where there's a business model that's starting to be proven out. But every now and again, we'll go a little bit earlier than that. In terms of our fund history, so my partner and co-founder, Aaron, and I started the fund 6 years ago. So we started in 2014, really with the mission of building a new kind of venture fund, the fund that used software and data science and data analytics at its core and enabled an outbound sourcing approach and model a lot earlier than historically had been applied. And one of our beliefs is that because companies today can get started with a lot less capital, they can grow a lot faster, they can do it in a much more capital efficient way, you can actually start to use data and data analytics to identify those exceptional companies a lot earlier than historically was possible and to invest in those companies to help them to scale and grow. So that's really what we do. And, you know, we started in 2014, raised our first fund back in 14, raised our first institutional fund in 2018. That was a $41 million fund, which we've been investing over the past two plus years. And now we're in the process of raising our third fund.
That's great. I'm obviously a pretty big fan and believer of the sort of data ingestion that you've brought into the early stage market. I think, you know, from your time at Insight, we certainly know that that data is a big part of the growth world, but not necessarily the early stage world. So I'm curious, as you think about sourcing in this sort of post-pandemic era, you know, what are some of the ways that you guys plan to leverage data and use it to help you evaluate, you know, companies that you otherwise may not be able to get in front of the same way you did traditionally?
Yeah, no, it's a really good question. And I think it kind of goes to the heart of our approach and kind of how we view the world. So, you know, our core beliefs are that today, if you think about deal sourcing, you can actually find great companies in a lot of different geographies. And you can find great businesses outside of what you might describe as the traditional technology hubs. If you just look over the past few years, you have companies, you know, like Qualtrics coming out of Utah, which is one of the largest SaaS acquisitions, you know, historically. You have great businesses coming out of, you know, Florida and in Chewy as an example. You know, New York is becoming a much bigger tech hub than it was with companies like Datadog and MongoDB. But you also even have, you know, smaller cities that are producing, you know, great businesses. You know, at Insight, you know, many of our best companies were ones that were really far off the beaten path that became large companies in software. And one of the reasons for that really is that software companies today require less capital than they did historically. They can grow a lot faster. And also you have, you know, pretty distributed, you know, technical talent that may not want to build a business in Silicon Valley. They may want to build it in their hometown, or they may want to build a very distributed team. You know, so for those reasons, you're seeing the ability to identify companies that are ones that the top firms may not see in the early days. You know, we did one study and we published it. We called it the top 5 myths of billion-dollar startups. And one thing we found most interesting is that if you look at the billion-dollar startups that exited over the last decade in software primarily, the majority of those didn't raise from a top firm at the seed. And even at the Series A, About 30% of those companies didn't raise from a top firm at Series A. So you still see a lot of inefficiency generally at the early stage. And we believe outbound sourcing and the use of data can advantage that. Now, to your question about post-COVID, I think there definitely are some nuances there in terms of what's happening. I think the first thing is you're seeing, obviously, that funds aren't able to meet with founders in person. So it requires you to be able to start to build relationships with founders, you know, remotely and really get to know founders in a way that you might not have done historically. Also, you know, you have to be able to kind of make investment decisions and really kind of, you know, put capital to work without having as many of the touch points in person as you might have. You know, one of our beliefs is that having kind of built the firm on this kind of outbound sourcing approach combined with using data and being able to do data analytics, it kind of advantages, you know, this, our model, in the sense of being able to do a lot of our work and analysis without having to, you know, take 5 or 10 meetings with a founding team. So I think more funds are probably starting to say, okay, like, how do we start to do more of this type of approach? You know, rather than relying solely on a network introduction or solely on, you know, being able to spend a lot of time with the founding team. So those are some of the things that are happening, and some of them are obviously longer term trends and some of them are kind of near term trends post COVID, but that's kind of what we're seeing.
Yeah, that's great. Let's talk a little bit about sort of differentiation in this market, and maybe we can start with the business side, but I also want to get your perspective on the investor side. You know, how should founders be thinking about differentiating their business in this environment? And then also would love to get your perspective on, you know, as you're going out trying to sign term sheets via Zoom, you know, how do you give the notion or perspective that your fund is the right
one to choose? Yeah, that's a great question. So in terms of differentiating your company as a founder, I think you really want to think about a couple of questions and really have great answers to those questions. I think the first question is whether your business is advantaged, you know, neutral or disadvantaged in the near term because of COVID. What you're finding is there are certain companies and categories that are advantaged that are doing very well and where there's a large demand. You know, those include, you know, technology companies that are providing software to enable remote work, to enable folks to work from home. You're seeing companies and categories, for example, like online delivery, you know, which are advantaged, or, you know, companies providing software for, you know, grocery stores or supermarkets that are advantaged. You know, we have in our portfolio two companies. One is called Lunchbox.io. The second one was called Rosie. So long story short, you know, both companies provide technology. One sells into the restaurant category. The second one sells into the grocery store category. But both are advantaged kind of in this environment where there's demand in much more consumer demand in those categories. And they're kind of arms merchants in those verticals. So long story short, like thinking through near-term impacts and whether your category is kind of advantaged, neutral, or disadvantaged. If you're in a disadvantaged category in the near term, it doesn't mean that you won't be able to raise capital, but it does mean I think you have to have a stronger story and a story around why you'll be able to weather the storm, especially in 2020, where it may take some time for some of those previous behaviors to come back, whether they be consumer behaviors or whether they be enterprise, you know, behaviors. You know, one of the terms that I've been using and our team has been using is this concept around kind of a behavioral change economy, where we're kind of in an economy where there's a lot of behavioral changes happening that are kind of forced behavioral changes. And I think, you know, VCs are thinking a lot about what some of those changes are and kind of how can companies take advantage of them. So I think regardless, kind of having both an explanation around near term and then long term strategy and approach and why your business model can work, I think is really important. I think some of the obvious things, you know, are still obviously the case in terms of having a large market opportunity, you know, being able to describe the domain expertise that you have as your founding team, you know, being able to kind of, you know, describe, you know, why you can build a very large company. I think those are consistent, but I do think thematically, you know, you're seeing VCs really think a lot about, you know, what the near and long-term impacts are for founders. I think in terms of investors, I think the way that investors are really showing, you know, showing differentiation in this environment is in a couple different ways. I think the first is being able to show ability to add value post-investment and oftentimes having to do that remotely. So for example, when we're pitching a founding team, we're talking a lot about, you know, how we can be helpful from the perspective of, you know, brand and story, how can be helpful in terms of helping companies build their sales teams. We do a lot in the form of introductions to customers and partners. So oftentimes we're describing how we're connected to folks who could be helpful. And we actually use our software platform Voyager to help identify kind of some of those touch points for founders. So we do a lot in terms of describing value add, ability to move quickly. I think a lot of founders in this day and age are wondering whether VCs are investing and whether they'll be able to invest in a reasonable amount of time. So articulating like how long it takes for you to make an investment decision. I think those are all things that founders are looking for and how they're deciding between funds to spend time with.
If you think about where you're spending time, obviously you guys write both consumer and enterprise checks. Like where do you think for a founder that's thinking about building right now and recognizing that you should build wherever you have domain expertise, but you know, where do you think more opportunities are going to present themselves in a post-pandemic era? Is it consumer opportunities or is it enterprise?
So I think a lot about really starting almost from first principles and saying, what are the behaviors that either consumers or enterprises are going to be engaging in that may be different than historical behaviors? And do you have a unique insight or perspective into what those behaviors are going to be? And can you kind of almost think about, you know, from first principles, what an industry might look like in the future? And I think it's actually a time for founders that it can be a great time, because a lot of the assumptions, you know, that may have been the key or may have been, you know, unchallenged historically may actually now be challenged. So as examples, if you think about, for example, the online travel agency as an example, right? You know, it's an industry that today is kind of looks very, very different than it did historically in terms of how people travel, you know, how they think about making a trip, a vacation, kind of where they may want to go, and what role can technology play in enabling them to either do that in a safer way, to do that in a way that's kind of, you know, more planned out. You know, there's a lot of opportunities for, I think, technology to, you know, enable kind of better travel in this kind of post-COVID world as an example. But there's all kinds of different examples. You know, we think about in our portfolio, we have a company called Squire, which is a software company selling into the barbershop and salon category. Squire is doing a lot to enable barbershops to kind of reopen, but the behaviors are very different in terms of folks having to book in advance, you know, less people being able to be in the barbershop or salon, you know, there needing to be social distancing within the barbershop. So what the Squire guys are doing is really playing a lead role in helping those business owners to really improve how they operate. So I think regardless of whether you're kind of a B2B or B2C founder, really thinking through those behavioral changes and how you can be, how you can kind of help your customers kind of navigate those challenges, I think is really key. I think specific to B2C, I think what you're finding is obviously behavioral changes in terms of folks that may not historically have purchased a lot online, you know, moving online, and in some cases, kind of moving online in very large numbers. So we've been studying specific areas of e-commerce, for example, where you're seeing very dramatic growth in terms of customer adoption of types of products that may have been available historically, but now folks that may have bought in person, now they're looking to buy online. So I think there's just a lot of behavioral changes. And I think as a founder, I think you just really want to think through what those are. And then can you have a unique approach to helping those to happen?
I'm curious for some of the teams that kind of already do exist, are there a different sort of set of unit economics that you think are important to keep an eye on today that maybe weren't as important 6 months ago, whether it's around retention, whether it's around, I think CAC has obviously changed a lot, but I'm curious if there are certain things in your portfolio that you're keeping an eye on.
I would say that a lot of the metrics themselves are the same, but the periods at which they're applied may be different and the requirements may be a little bit higher. So let me see if I can explain that. So if you think about, for example, months of runway that a company has between rounds, what you might've seen over the past few years is at the max, you know, 18 months of runway, but practically speaking, a really good, you know, SaaS company at seed might be raising a Series A within 12 months and maybe raising say a $10 million Series A at a $30 million pre, you know, even before, you know, 12 months elapsed post the seed round. Now it might look like, you know, more like 24 months kind of between funding rounds. especially if you're in a category that was disadvantaged in 2020, that may take a little while to come back. So we're thinking a lot about, do companies have more runway to be able to show milestones? And in particular, in terms of growth milestones, you may not see the level of growth. Definitely, you, in a lot of categories, you won't see the level of growth in 2020 that you might see in 2021. Can you show, you know, the 100%+ year-on-year revenue growth in 2021, whereas it might be much more diminished in 2020? And so kind of rates of growth, I think, also may not be what they once were, or the bar may not be as high there in terms of rate of growth for 2020. But I do think kind of, you know, top investors, especially Series A investors, are still continuing to look for, you know, strong revenue retention, you know, kind of negative net revenue churn for companies, you know, low, you know, customer account churn. I think those things will remain consistent. But I do think in terms of the amount of runway that companies need to have, the amount of time it takes to get to their next rounds, you know, that may be a little bit different over the next, you know, say 6 to 12 months.
Let's talk a little bit about from the investor side of that table, you know, the term sheet process. So I think traditionally, you know, maybe if you have any kind of numbers to play off of, you can use market comps and multiples to get there. Market comps and multiples might look a little different in 6 months from now than they traditionally did. And so as you think about comping companies and helping them understand how you got to evaluation, are there any new tools or things that you plan to use that you think will be helpful in this environment to just sort of help founders and investors?
Yeah, so there are some new approaches and in paradigms or frameworks that you might see, you know, investors using. I think you're right that, you know, public comps are, you know, lower, I should say, you know, in terms of multiples than they might have been 6 or 12 months ago. There isn't as much exit activity in terms of IPOs and M&A. And I do think, you know, folks are more conservative in terms of the entry prices that they may be paying for companies. I think if you step back and think about venture kind of as an asset class, it's a very cyclical asset class. I think what you saw in the past few years is kind of record highs in terms of the amount of capital coming into the system and in terms of the amount of money being put into deals. And so the way that typically equilibrates in the venture business is, you know, those deals don't do as well, those funds don't do as well, the vintages aren't as strong. And then the feedback loop typically is for things to slow down, for valuations to start to drop, and for investors to be, I think, more disciplined. And I think you'll start to see that cycle start to play itself out. So that's kind of the macro. In terms of the micro, in terms of kind of how investors, you know, value, I think the smartest investors that we respect think a lot about this kind of return the fund framework, which, you know, a lot of folks might have heard about or applied in their funds. It's really what we do. We spend a lot of time thinking through, in an upside, you know, scenario, kind of how large can a company get and how much of our fund can it potentially return, and what are some of the nuances around the upside. And that's really important to kind of step back and really think through that framework, because it enables you to take a long view. You know, you start to think less about the next year or 2 years and more, you know, 5 or 10 years in terms of what the long-term potential of the business could be. And I think that framework kind of keeps you honest in terms of what an entry price might be today. So really kind of not losing sight of the large kind of long-term opportunity in terms of return on the fund. And so you don't get too precise or too picky around $1 million here, $1 million there in terms of valuation. You really think through what the company could be worth in the long term. So those are some of the frameworks that we think about.
I'm curious what type of advice you're sharing in terms of best practices with founders of your portfolio companies around effectively communicating with their teams in what is, you know, a now very remote environment. I think some people were able to do it when it was only going to last 3 to 4 weeks, and now we're kind of going on 3 to 4 months. I'm curious if you've seen any teams do it really well.
I do think that companies that were used to having a partially distributed or in some cases fully distributed team are obviously much more prepared for this. I think it's really the companies that didn't have those approaches where, you know, everybody might be in one office or kind of coming in and working together every day that are definitely feeling the change in terms of their operations. I think there's a couple of things that we've seen our founders do that I think have worked really well to kind of keep morale high. I think the obvious thing is kind of like enabling regular interaction on the team that kind of outside of a, you know, a normal business context, that could be having a happy hour periodically. That could be, you know, creating a forum for folks to just to kind of talk about how they're doing and how they're feeling and things that may be happening outside of work. Obviously kind of using, you know, tools to enable kind of, you know, regular communication, whether that be Slack or, you know, Zoom, you know, kind of enabling people to kind of stay in communication. And you know, we're seeing, you know, different tools, you know, new startups kind of releasing different tools that can be helpful in that. I think those companies will start to really get, you know, good traction. So, you know, those are some of the things. I think also, you know, articulating kind of a long view combined with making some of those, you know, tougher decisions earlier on. So I think one characteristic of top founders that you've seen over the past few months is really identifying, you know, what the challenges might be. You know, if for example, your revenue is dropped, you know, dramatically and you have to make, you know, layoffs, kind of making those sooner than later, being clear to your full team kind of why those were made and describing kind of plans for rehiring. I think a lot of our best founders did those analyses relatively quickly and kind of were conservative and saying, look, you know, how do we, you know, if anything, kind of like make more cuts than we might need to kind of make sure nothing needs to happen in the future, or let's be more gradual in terms of new hires to kind of make sure, you know, that we're kind of not overhiring for areas that have been advantaged. So those are some of the characteristics, I think, of what I think top companies are doing. But I think across the board, it's a very, very challenging time for founders and really unprecedented in terms of what founders have to deal with right now.
I think that's actually a good one to end on. I'm curious if you have any advice, you know, in particular for people of color. I think, you know, raising money as a person of color in an 11-year bull market was tough, and it certainly just got even tougher. And so, you know, as someone that has obviously dealt with some of those things in your investing and entrepreneurial career.
Great question. There's a couple different pieces of advice that I try to impart. And I think everybody is familiar with the challenges that minority founders have in terms of raising capital and some of the statistics that are, you know, really kind of dispiriting in terms of the percentage of capital raised and you know, across the board, you know, a lot of the stats. But I do think there's a couple of things that are maybe silver linings or things that, you know, founders can think about that may be motivational. I think the first thing is, and I always get back to this, is that kind of, you know, necessity is the mother of invention. I think oftentimes many of the best deals that I've been a part of at Insight or at 645 were companies that were very, very capital efficient, that had low burn, that oftentimes didn't raise a lot of money at seed, that kind of built themselves really intelligently. And then when they kind of really figured out a business model and an approach, then they raise more capital. And they, in the plus side of that is you retain more of your business, you take less dilution, you can be pickier, so to speak, over time in terms of the investors you select. So there is a silver lining, so to speak, to not raising a lot of capital in the early days, especially if you're in a business that's not super capital intensive. I think that being said, you know, if you're a founder kind of raising capital, you know, you have to really think through, you know, how do you get in front of the right investors? You know, how do you kind of tell the right story? You know, how can you leverage your network? And also, you know, are there ways for you to get on the radar screen of top investors where you might not have been able, where you might not be able to do that, you know, obviously now in terms of an in-person meeting. So really being strategic and kind of thoughtful about doing that, I think is really important. I think one of the other bright spots you see in the market is, you know, there are more funds that are kind of making it part of their mission to invest in diverse founders that are getting started and getting built. You know, I would describe, you know, Harlem Capital as one that's doing, you know, great work. And there are many others. There are many more, you know, Black GPs than when I started my career back in 2002. So there definitely are some silver linings there. But regardless, I think it's definitely a challenging period. And, you know, I think as a minority founder, you know, there are challenges you have to really think through, but you know, at the end of the day, I think the best founders kind of find a way, and they're resilient, and they kind of make their way through. And I think that can make you a lot stronger over the long term. So, you know, that's kind of my assessment of it.
Yeah, I love it.
Namdi, thanks for being here.
You're doing a great thing. I really enjoy this podcast series, and it's a real pleasure to be a part of it.